Joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is my good friend, who I haven't seen for a while, Jason DeSanto. He's on the faculty at Northwestern's School of Law, where he's a senior lecturer. And maybe I say it wrong, but I always understood you to kind of specialize in speaking, political speech, words, and how words matter, or in this case, do they matter anymore?
Well, thanks, Rick. Yeah, I mean, I try to do a lot of work in the advocacy area and a lot of years as a speechwriter in politics as well. And I think words do matter. That clip you played there from Mark Warner, he's really talking about the president's propensity to run down anything that constrains his power. And one of the ways you do that is through language and questioning the rule of law, questioning judges, questioning the FBI, questioning those institutions. It was Jeb Bush who said that the president was the chaos candidate, and really it is a destabilizing factor. That is what he is about. When nothing is true, everything is true. Anything that constrains his power is to be destabilized. And he does that through language. And that's what, you know, it used to be at 140 characters at, yes, on Twitter, and now we've got, you know, 280. He makes good use of those as well. And the State of the Union was another example of that, though a bit different.
Well, I don't think it's wrong to necessarily question institutions, in fact. But this is obviously a, more than questioning, it's a discrediting effort to try to, in the end game, discredit whatever may come out as tainted or biased or whatever when Bob Mueller finishes his investigation.
Skepticism is great. That's what self-government is about, is the ability to question institutions because the institutions are supposed to work for us. But the president goes beyond that because he doesn't, if you notice, he questions those institutions when they seem to be getting in his way. Now, he's not the first president to have done that. I mean, Franklin Delano Roosevelt did that. He tried to pack the Supreme Court.
Right.
So presidents tend to bridle against power. He definitely does that. But to me, it's a pattern. And of course, it's the press. It's law enforcement. It's the courts. Anything that tends to brush up against what he wants to do. And I think the irony of that is those are institutions that are supposed to aid self-government, well, not oppose self-government.
And even taking it further, those are institutions that Republicans have traditionally been the strongest supporters of, law enforcement and justice and those kinds of things. And so you find this president trying to parse his way about, oh, you know, I support law enforcement or whatever. At the same time, he's trying to take down one of the pillars of law enforcement.
Well, that's what destabilizing is about. And it's no small irony that there are probably plenty of liberals who have had problems with the way the FISA court operates.
Sure.
Largely in secret, I mean, totally in secret, and unless something gets leaked or, you know, Snowden came across something and was able to put things out into the public domain without representation of, you know, the people who are about to be surveilled. And yet, now it's Trump taking those positions as well. And that, I mean, that really does in some way speak to the notion of up is down is up. And that's fine if you are somebody who's trying to really muddy the waters. And that is a lot of what his work as a speaker and as a communicator is about.
But it's in a defensive posture.
Actually, I disagree with that.
Okay,
it's turning defense into offense. I mean, that is the posture. That's the old Roy Cohn postulate. His old mentor, who had worked with Joe McCarthy before that, was you're never on the defensive. You're always on the offensive, and that's the way language is to be deployed, among other weapons.
Well, let's talk about the State of the Union address. And a lot of people watched, not as many as the president claimed.
Right.
Again. But, and generally got good marks in surveys done by the individual networks, including the ones he derides for spreading fake news, that the viewers generally gave it good marks. And I think part of that was, you know, goes back again to his previous speech before a joint session of Congress, which technically wasn't a State of the Union address, but it was composed and it was on the prompter.
Right.
And I think the prompter makes a big difference with this president.
The usual rule of thumb is when you hear a double adverb.
Okay. Example.
Totally. So totally. very wonderful, right?
Okay.
Some kind of adjective and an adverb. Then the president's gone off the prompter, okay, at that point, when he's sort of adding those things. Otherwise, he's on the prompter. And so the speech was relatively well received. In some ways, that's because, and this was the same when Bill Clinton was president, sometimes what the experts see as being a speech that doesn't work is something that actually does relatively well among the public. When Bill Clinton was president, people used to say all the time, those speeches are too long. They ran at over an hour. And yet, when they were actually polled in various sections in each of the proposals, they polled quite high. And it could be that the Trump speech, to those who are the analysts, is seen as, you know, it's just him and he's on the prompter. It may be within the public, it's perceived as, oh, he's marking a new course. He's acting the way a president should. And there was a Monmouth poll at the end of the week that shows his approval ratings have bounced back up to about 42%. How much of that is due to the speech is hard to say, but it is possible that he is being perceived in a positive way, partially because of the speech itself.
But even when you go back to that speech a year ago and you look at this speech, and people at times view this as some kind of a resetting of this presidency to be more presidential, but then invariably, as happened after the first speech, we're back into the same kind of game again.
Well, this is a lot about credibility. And way back centuries ago, when good old Aristotle was talking about persuasion, he talked about the way that people were persuaded, and one of those is through logic, through facts and reasoning, another is through emotion, through feelings and stories, and the last one is really the credibility of the speaker. And I take it that if you heard the speech on Tuesday night, it was all about credibility. The other thing sort of fell to the wayside because we're inclined, if you believe Trump, to enjoy what he's saying, and if you don't like Trump, to not enjoy what he's saying. Last year, the speech you mentioned, he gave that speech, and then a week later, he was tweeting out about having been wiretapped by President Obama, right? So it seemed normal, and then a couple days later, it wasn't. This time around, we had the speech itself, and then the Nunes memo was going to come out a couple days after that. It's hard to take somebody at face value when they are talking about bipartisanship, when they have run a campaign impugning a whole series of ethnicities and races, when they have conducted themselves as president in the past year by saying that there are good people on both sides of a racial debate in Charlottesville.
Right.
So if you're inclined to remember those incidents, you don't think the president has much credibility on something like unity and seeming normalizing and stable. If, in fact, you think the president was on the right side in those debates, you think that that was more than credible. That's the cut of the man, and that's who he is. So, I mean, to some extent, the view is going to depend on the point of view.
And the preconceived notions that exist.
Yeah, and that's one of the challenges, I think, with any State of the Union. I think it was, to some extent, the same thing with somebody like Barack Obama, who had virulent enemies, and they were not going to take anything that he said at face value. I mean, that's why somebody could yell, "You lie," in the middle of a joint session on health care. And of course, Clinton as well, and probably to some extent Bush. But I think Trump creates those feelings at a deeper level and across the partisan divide. And so maybe 42% is the ceiling of people who would be inclined to see what he's saying is credible when it comes to the idea of unity.
We're speaking with Jason DeSanto. He's a senior lecturer at Northwestern School of Law. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio and Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Joining me here in studio is Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern School of Law. We're talking about the president's State of the Union address. We'll talk about State of the State in the next half hour with Amanda Vinicky. But we're talking about also words, how they're used, the power of words in these kinds of speeches. And given kind of the general public reaction that we talked about that from the network polls towards a positive, towards the speech, did Democrats make a mistake by sitting on their hands for the entire speech?
I don't think so. It seems like every year there's some great hue and cry about what the other side did and whether they sat and looked stone-faced and everything else. But that has become normalized.
I was going to say, that is the new normal.
And so, to me, that is not really a large scale issue. To me, it's what the person who is at the microphone is saying and how they are appealing to people at home. Now, it can be said, it's always useful to appear like the reasonable person in the room. So if you're saying things that everybody ought to get behind and people are not clapping, that's going to make you look like the reasonable person. I think Barack Obama used that to great effect. But I didn't think that that was really what was going on the other night. Most of those issues where there was the sitting on the hands and where it was most clear were on things like immigration.
I was just going to bring that up.
And the immigration section of the speech was essentially the Trump inaugural extended into this speech. And what I mean by that, Rick, is the Trump inaugural was noted for talking about American carnage and
Right.
the fact that America was a disaster. That was all done through language. That was a painting of a picture, a telling of a story that a lot of people don't really experience in their own lives, but a way to show this kind of dystopia. Most of this speech the other night did not do that, but the immigration section did. And it did through the painting of the picture of this criminal gang, MS-13. There were six mentions of MS-13. There were several stories. It was linked to terrorism, clumsily to opioid
Right.
abuse. And then, of course, there was a rather dramatic story about a couple of teenage girls who had been killed by MS-13 as well. And all of that is done. And by the way, one mention of Russia, six mentions of MS-13. And all of that is done to create what I think is an extension from the inaugural, which is a vision of the world where citizens and the idea of citizenship isn't necessarily being bonded to one another, but rather is living in fear, and the kind of fear that this president can protect you from. And that is really, to me, what that section was about. And that led into the proposed compromise on immigration reform. That was the entry to the section, was that there was a great security problem that needed to be rooted out. That kind of language is not going to be the kind of thing that a lot of Democrats are going to get behind. That is just not a story that seems like an even-handed approach to what the nature of the immigration problem is. It is, like most effective rhetoric, a framing device. A way to understand the problem of immigration is through this criminal marauding band called MS-13. I think most people who look at the immigration issue would not say that is really what the immigration issue is fundamentally about. And so that's a rhetorical choice. And it's not a rhetorical choice that is really going to create common ground.
Well, rhetorical choice, trying to simplify it in basic terms on an issue that is, quite frankly, so complicated. That's part of the reason why we haven't had any kind of comprehensive immigration reform, though it's been talked about even from George W. Bush's days. And simplifying it in a way, using the rhetorical devices to paint it in the way you want it painted.
Yeah, and there's nothing about that that is strange for a politician, for an orator to do. It's what we do with language. The best stories are the ones that are the most vivid in the fewest number of words. What was interesting about that particular portion of the speech was pointing up into the gallery,
right,
having the parents of the two girls who had been killed there. I think it was pointed out by James Fallows with The Atlantic that most of the time when presidents do that, when they point somebody out, and even in this speech too, most of the time it's to valorize somebody's
heroes. They're
people,
heroes.
People whose character embodies America and who we in this chamber need to follow. This was one of the first times that people were identified who were victims, that the people were there for us to see their victimhood. And I take it that that was done because the desire in that portion of the speech was to put us in the position of being victims. And this goes back to what I said before, which is, again, in most State of the Union addresses, most inaugural addresses, most farewell addresses, what presidents are doing is trying to reconstitute the citizenry. There's something ritualistic about these events. We all come together. We recognize the democracy. We share bonds with each other. And even the term my fellow citizens, my fellow Americans, is designed to create those bonds. That's not what's going on in these portions of these Trump speeches. It is not a call for people to see what they share and could do together. What's happening in these situations is it's a call for citizens to see themselves as being surrounded and needing help. And the help needs to come from one person. And that's why you played a portion of the speech before the break where Trump was talking about who his oath was and what his duty was, it's very personalized.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in the inaugural, it was, my oath is to the American people and my duty is to the American people. And it's creating that one-to-one bond between the leader and those people who need protection. That is a very different thing. It's certainly not what Ronald Reagan did. It's certainly not what Bill Clinton or Barack Obama or George W. Bush did. And it is kind of this maximalist approach to power. Some might just say it's egocentric. But I think when you tie it to the idea of running down other institutions within government, it looks a little bit different than simply egocentric. It begins to look like somebody who believes that they should have all that power.
Where does persuasion fall into this, though? And because you have the kind of the speech that tries to influence people to feel that they're victims or to create the impression that they're victims. But when I think of persuasion in politics, I think of it normally in a larger kind of sense. It kind of like what you were saying about we're all in this together in a shared kind of mission to whatever in more kind of grandiose terms than like, I would say more blunt terms that Trump uses.
Yeah. Well, I think this is probably what becomes frustrating to Trump supporters, because they hear a Trump speech and they hear things like the police and the flag and veterans and the national anthem and loyalty and Americans. And what they're hearing is these are all the things we rally around. These are the things that unite us. But what people who don't support Trump hear are those same words, but they understand them through the prism of all the other things, the victimhood, the fear, Colin Kaepernick, tweets about the national anthem, the Muslim ban. And so when they hear those words, they either hear them as hypocritical or they hear them with a shading, which means, I know what that is. That's coded language. You're speaking to your supporters in one way and you're trying to win us over in a different way, but that's not what we're going to go for. And that really is the question of credibility. And so, again, it becomes very difficult after a year, 2 years of kind of seeing somebody in the public arena to take those calls to unity and bipartisanship at face value, because we're just not hearing them that way.
Because people have already, I mean, once again, it's the preconceived notion and it's their construction and through their own filter, that's how they, their own prism of how they see what is being said.
His credibility is being judged through the prism of carnage. Right, we hear somebody who has described something as carnage, and when we hear that, it becomes more difficult to judge him as being credible. And he does all the other things that presidents do. He takes credit for things that may or may not have actually been things
stock
that he did.
Market,
right?
I mean, that's right.
I mean, that is what people do in these situations. Unlike somebody like Bill Clinton, who was doing that in the middle of his own perceived crisis, Clinton had about 5 years of presidency to point to where cause and effect could at least be more correlated in terms of economic development, right? And here,
sure,
Trump did what Clinton did. He just sort of ignored all the things about the controversy outside of the room. For Clinton, it was Lewinsky. For Trump, it's the Russia investigation. And you just sort of cite the indicators that are positive. But of course, if you are somebody who isn't a Trump fan, you're going to say, you've only been president for a year. I mean, everything you cite has been already in a positive way for the past 3 or 4 years. And so again, we're a little less inclined to believe the messenger because of things that have come before.
That's Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at Northwestern School of Law, an expert on words and how words are used. I always enjoy these conversations.
Me
very
too,
much.
Rick.
We'll do it again
okay.
Very soon.
All right, thanks for having me.